Hey, good evening. And welcome to the regularly scheduled October 4th meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board met previously in closed session. We discussed one student personnel item, a stipulated expulsion hearing, and also anticipated one item of anticipated litigation. It was discussion only. No action was taken. Do we have consensus on the order of business? No, wait. We need to take action on one of the items in closed session, now in open session.
That is listed on your agenda in a couple of steps, so you don't need to do that right now.
It's a little ways down? Okay. So then, do we have consensus on the order of business, Mrs. Holmes?
I do need to request that you consider a change to the agenda. This is most unusual. There are provisions in the Brown Act that you can add an item to tonight's agenda under certain circumstances, and those would be that the board may act upon an item not appearing on a regular agenda upon finding that there is a need for immediate action and that need came to our attention after the agenda was posted. The body must make a finding by a two-thirds vote of the members present. And what I want to explain to you is that we have a field trip that came to our office just today for our students to travel to Indianapolis for national competition, and that trip will be on October 16th before we have our next board meeting. And those sorts of field trips require the board's approval. So what we're asking is that you make the finding that the circumstances meet the criteria of the Brown Act to add that to the agenda, and it will appear in the consent item for your approval later tonight.
Okay, is the board? What we need is a two-thirds thumbs up.
I move that we, that due to the immediacy of the situation, and that it was not able to be added to the agenda prior to publication of the agenda, that we add that item regarding a field trip to Indianapolis before the next board meeting on this agenda in the consent agenda portion. Does that work, Kim?
Yes, thank you.
And I will second it on the condition I understand what group it is and for what purpose.
It is a San Luis Obispo High School FFA group going to the national competition or the national meet in Indianapolis.
I second.
All in favor? Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. So we'll revisit that then on consent.
And I apologize, but there should be a specific item listed for your action on the closed session item, and I don't see it. So if we could take that action as part of item 3.1 so we can record what you did in closed session
okay.
on the expulsion.
So I am seeking a motion on item 2.01, student personnel stipulated expulsion hearing, EC 48900-48927.
I would move, how do we do this, that we are in agreement with the recommendation as presented.
Okay, and I'll second that. So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by myself, and did you have a question, Mr. Buckman?
Quick question. Do we need to state that in the
Kim, do we need to state in the motion the cause? There's two causes that we would need.
No.
Okay, thank you.
So then we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by myself. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. And other than Mrs. Holmes, there were no other issues with the order of business? Okay. Then I'm seeking approval of the minutes of 9:16.
I'll move approval of the minutes of 9:16.
I'll second.
So I have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Yes, you may. So, opposed? That passes 7-0. And again, seeking approval of the minutes of 9:20.
I'll move approval of the minutes of 9:20, 2016.
So I have a motion by Mr. Millar, second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That also passes 7-0. Moving on, we have our student representatives to the board. I'll begin with Mark Hajiani from Morro Bay High School.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Last week was our homecoming week with our game versus Cabrillo on Friday. Unfortunately, that was our first loss, but I'm sure we'll get back on our winning streak. Everyone was still extremely excited because at halftime we had a parade and we crowned the king and queen, which is a tradition at Morro Bay High School for homecoming. Also last week, our ASB put on a variety of events, including a lunchtime carnival, where all the clubs were able to sell food to raise money for future events and their activities. Our customary pregame pep rally was held the day of the game, and our dance team, cheer squad, and drum circle were all able to showcase their talents and create some school-wide hype. So, it's also entertaining. Finally, last week, we finished off with a formal homecoming dance put together by ASB, and we sold over 280 tickets, which is twice as many as last year. So, outside of school, our sign-ups for Big Brothers, Big Sisters, which, as you may know, is when students volunteer to mentor an elementary school student at Del Mar. And we're looking for, we're expecting good turnouts with that. The Morro Bay Science and Ag Department has started selling eggs every Wednesday, just from chickens solely tended by the students. The Morro Bay Surf Team, as well, is having their annual meeting this Friday, it looks like. And last year they raised over $5,000 from that one meeting alone. So we're hoping for the same coming Friday. And that is about it for Morro Bay right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have Caroline Pettihome from San Luis Obispo High School.
Yes. Hi, thank you. So in sports this week at San Luis High, we had away volleyball games this week and last. Football last Friday, we played St. Joseph, and unfortunately we had a loss, but it was hard fought. It was also the band and cheer senior night, so all of the seniors involved in band and cheer were recognized. Cross country is doing well, and also tennis is doing great as well. And girls golf is on a winning streak, so that's good for us. In ASB news, last Friday was our fall sports rally, so we recognized all of the fall sports, and it was turn of the century theme, so a lot of 90s, 2000s style was represented, so that was really interesting. This week is Mental Health Awareness Week, so each day of the week we're focusing on different mental health illnesses. So on Monday, we have eating disorders, and we play videos on the bulletin every day showcasing, the signs of it, what to do if you notice your friend or a colleague is going through something, and how to help. So Monday is eating disorder. Tuesday is depression and suicide awareness. And for that, we held an annual semicolon day, which, if you don't know, the Semicolon Project is a depression and suicide awareness program. And the semicolon is their mascot, essentially. And the semicolon is used when an author could have ended a sentence but chose not to. So it's a metaphor, and you are the author, and the semicolon is your life, or the sentence is your life, excuse me. On Wednesday, we're focusing on anxiety, and at break, we're having trivia about facts on mental health, and you can win prizes. On Thursday, we're focusing on bipolar disorder, and at lunch, we're holding a mental health fair. It's a Club Rush type feel, and a bunch of mental health societies and programs throughout San Luis County are going to come to our school and kind of offer their services to our students at lunch. And on Friday, we are focusing on obsessive compulsive disorder. And after the bulletin on Friday, we're opening up class discussions about mental health and what you've seen and what you've experienced, so that should be really healthy for the students. Also, our health teacher, Mr. Monroe, was teaching health classes about mental health and specific mental health illnesses to kind of coincide and emphasize importance of this week. This week is also, it's a big week at Slohi, it's also Hispanic Culture Week, and so our Commissioner of Cultural Awareness, Andrea Hernandez, is recognizing different Central and Southern American regions cultures. So today at lunch they held a mini dance class to learn salsa dancing, and we're going to have other activities like that throughout the week at lunch as well. Friday will be another honor roll recipient barbecue for all the juniors, and so it's a free barbecue for every junior that's earned a 4.0 GPA or higher. Our homecoming week is set for October 17th through 22nd. Also, the winners of the FCCLA Iron Chef competition were students Carolyn Cromhouse, Alessandra Rizzo, Grace Gibson, and Victoria Cromhouse. So they won, I believe, I actually don't know what they won. Bragging rights. Let's see. Last Wednesday, our FFA hosted sectional FFA speaking competition, and the freshmen dominated in all of the competition, and our officer team took first place as well. Our ELK student of the month is Juan Rodriguez, Bryce Ramirez, Maggie Van Scoy, and Shayna Morris for September-October. And to finish up, we are also offering peer tutoring in the library after school. So that should be fun, tutored by your peers. Thank you.
Thank you. Very busy at Slohi. Are there any board questions? Okay, then seeing none, it's the usual. You're welcome to stay. We would love to have your participation if you choose to, but we're mindful that you have many other things that you're involved in, including homework, so please feel free to leave at any time with our thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item is the California Healthy Kids Survey, presented by Chris Dowler and Diane Frost.
Good evening. I'm Diane Frost. I'm the Director of Student Services, and I'm here with Chris Dowler, who will help out as well, who is the Deputy Director of Student Services, and we'd like to give you some information about the California Healthy Kids Survey. Is it working? There we go. A little history about the California Healthy Kids Survey. It's provided to 7th, 9th, and 11th grade students. So that's every 2 years as they travel through those grades. And the California Department of Education has been providing this since 97. The survey typically covers issues related to school climate. So you're going to see some information regarding drugs, alcohol, tobacco use, student connectivity, and school safety issues as well. The CDE funded the California Healthy Kids Survey for a number of reasons. They wanted to foster a positive school climate, they wanted to prevent youth health risky behaviors, and they wanted to promote youth development, resilience, and well-being. There's a couple of cautions I want to relate to you. First of all, the California Healthy Kids Survey is really a dipstick in time. This is one day that all of these kids are responding to these questions, and any number of variables might affect each response. In addition, we really feel like the data should be looked at in comparisons over time. So not just that year, but look at comparisons over time. And actually, Chris Dowler, who has spent a lot of time mining this data for us, has done just that. He has gone back several years so we can see what our trend lines are. Tonight, we're going to look at longitudinal data, and these are the areas that we're going to be looking at. Fear of violence at school, reports of being harassed on campus, use of marijuana, alcohol, and tobacco, and then school connectivity. All right, we're going to start with this one. And sometimes the California Healthy Kids Survey can be just a little bit confusing in their questions, so I want to read this one to you. This is the percentage of 7th, 9th, and 11th graders reporting not experiencing an act of or a fear of violence. So clearly you want these numbers to be high. What you can see here is that 85% of our 7th graders are not experiencing fear of violence, while the state average is 81. So we're achieving high, or our kids are reporting higher than the state average. 85% of our 9th graders are not experiencing fear of violence, while the state average is roughly 85, so we're right there. And then our 11th graders, 91% of our 11th graders are not experiencing fear of violence, while the state average is right at 89%. So doing pretty well there. This data does show that the vast majority of students on our campus are not experiencing an act of or a fear of violence.
Mr. Malone.
Diane, can I ask you a quick question?
Yes. Well, let me go back.
So that's fear of violence at school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm
sorry, I can't go back.
The question was going to be more. That's okay.
Okay.
It was more about are we dipsticking a general level of anxiety for the age group, or it's pretty.
Yes, you can, Chris.
Thanks,
so it's actually a composite data of a lot of different question points. So it's a composite of whether or not they actually experience a certain kind of violence. There's actually about 3 or 4 different questions that get averaged into this rate and compared to the state overall. So it could be actually having experience being pushed, assaulted, mutual fight, or being afraid of being assaulted.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Kim, I think we might have to do this one by one because this is not responding very well.
Take them to the next slide and I'll give you tips as to when to go. All right, so our next slide. Average percentage of students from grades 7, 9, and 11 reporting any harassment at all. You can see that over the last 3 survey years, so 2012, 14, and 16, we've had a steady decline in the number of students reporting any harassment, and we are below the state average. So the state average is 36% of students report some type of harassment. We are sitting at 33. We still see that as 1/3 of our students, and we're not happy with 1/3, but looking at the state average and looking at the trend line, we think we're going in the right direction. Kim, the next slide. This is kind of an interesting piece, and I'm not showing.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Sort of following up on what Walter asked before, mm-hmm. How do we define harassment? So is it sexual harassment, things like that? When we think about harassment, is it teasing? And I would just be curious, do we know what the difference is between girls and boys reporting reporting harassment and what those things might look like?
It's curious. So part one of your question has to do with how does it define harassment? And it's really curious. I really don't like this particular area, this particular reporting set of data in the Healthy Kids Survey, because it doesn't provide the student with context to answer the question, nor does it provide us with any real context for that answer. So it does ask students, have you ever been harassed due to gender, ability level, race, sexual orientation, and it goes through these federally protected classes, really, saying, have you ever been harassed for this? Our student response rates to those are very, very low, very, very small. And then it asks another question, have you ever experienced harassment for any other reason? And then it gives a report, any harassment at all, and you can't tell where this number came up with. So our response rates to all other forms of harassment are small, and then it balloons to 33%. But this is a number that is publicly available. It's been reported in the paper before. It's a number that people read, and so therefore it's comparable across the state and across the county. So it's worth noting and responding to. But as you said, we're not sure what exactly kind of harassment. It seems to be very generalized. So that's your first question. The second question is, can we break this down and disaggregate this by gender? I think we can. The Healthy Kids Survey does a good job breaking this down by gender. I just don't know the number off the top of my head.
So, Chris, that could include harassment on social media?
It doesn't define the parameters of the harassment in the Healthy Kids Survey. It does define that at school, but it doesn't define, whether it's verbal harassment, physical harassment, online harassment, texting. It doesn't define the scope of it. Have you been? It it doesn't tell kids what harassment is. So we're not sure whether or not this is a kid in class saying, hey, you're a jerk, or something else.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. Diane, I appreciate you talked about the one-third and that we're you know, a couple of percentage points below the state, but this is an ongoing one-third since 2008, and I know the district has attempted different interventions for this, which from the numbers appear maybe not to be working.
Well, I don't know if I'd agree with that. When you see going from 39 to 36 to 33, I think that is showing a little bit of improvement. And as we go through here, you'll see that I do have a couple of slides that talk about programs on our campuses that are addressing this.
Great.
So that might answer your question.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. All right, Kim, do you mind moving forward to 8? So this is something I wanted you to consider, and again, this is not longitudinal data. This is just from this year. What we're saying here is that students are reporting fewer acts of violence at the school over the past 11 years. There is still not a corresponding increase in the perception of very safe. So they have a rubric that they're reporting on, very safe, safe, unsafe. Very safe across 7, 9, and 11 is 31%, 18%, 25%. But look at safe. Safe is 51%, 51%, 46%. We want to move those kids up in their perception of having a very safe campus and not simply a safe campus. But again, if you look at that red number, that's the state average. We are still better than the state average, but the bar we're setting for ourselves is higher. Mark, you asked a little bit about programs. We do have school climate or bullying prevention programs in San Luis Coastal. Positive behavior intervention supports, or something that you might know as PBIS, is at three of our elementary schools. I've got C.L. Smith, Del Mar, and Baywood. C.L. Smith having had the program for the longest. This is a program where attention is focused on creating tiered supports and interventions by making targeted misbehavior less effective, efficient, relevant, etc. This is something that Chris Staller has worked for quite a long time, you know, relatively speaking, with C.L. Smith and these other schools, and hopes over the years to even further embed this. Kim, the next one. You might remember these from our LCAP. WEB is a middle school orientation program where we're trying to transition our kids and make sure that they're able to connect with other kids on campus. Same thing with Link Crew, but at the high school level. And then one more. And then finally, restorative justice or restorative approaches. Again, a program that Chris Staller has been working on with our secondary schools. So if you read through there, it says a behavioral support model philosophically rooted in the belief that wrongdoing is best addressed through collectively identifying the harm done by one's actions and taking steps to repair that harm. So he's been working with secondary administrators on restorative approaches, visiting schools who have implemented the program, looking at ways to implement it on our own campuses. Okay, Kim? All right, now we're going to turn to some data about marijuana, alcohol, and tobacco use among our students. And this, the data that you're seeing here is represented a little bit differently. This is represented in trend lines. So blue, if you see a blue line, they've never tried the substance. If you see a red line, they've tried the substance 1 to 3 times. And if you see a yellow line, they've tried the substance or reported so 4 or more times. Clearly, the blue line is the percentage that we want to hit. We want that to be the greatest percentage. You'll also see that once again, we have our state averages reported there. So starting here with marijuana, you'll see that our seventh graders are better than the state average at 98%, never having tried the substance. Our ninth graders are better than the state average at 82%. Never having tried the substance. And then our 11th graders are behind the state average. So the state average is 62% never having tried the substance, and our 11th graders are only at 54%. Kim, if you move forward, here's alcohol use. Our trend lines in both 7th and 9th grade have exactly the trajectory that we want. More and more students choosing to abstain. Our trend line for 8th graders is not exactly, or 11th graders, excuse me, is not exactly what we want to see. Looking at the state averages, both 7th and 9th graders are abstaining to a greater percent than the state average, and our 11th graders are below the state average for abstaining, so 42% as compared to 48%. And then finally, moving on to cigarette smoking.
I'm sorry, can I just ask a quick question about
yes.
alcohol? So in past years, going fairly far back, mm-hmm. There is a line in the California Health, in the CHKS about binge drinking.
Okay.
If you had an opportunity to pull that out yet, or should I just talk to Chris later?
We could talk to Chris later. I don't know if you have that data at the tip
well,
of your fingers.
I have the data. I just haven't broken it up.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's been interesting.
So information about binge drinking.
Yeah. I'll just
happy
talk
to do that. Happy to do that. All right. Moving on to lifetime cigarette smoking. So the next three slides are going to look at tobacco use over the years. And added to this data the last couple of years is a new tobacco product, and that's vape and e-cigarette device use. So here's 7th grade, 99% abstaining with a state average of 97%. We're also above the state average for students who abstain from the vape and e-cigarette. And then if you move to the next slide, for our 9th graders, 91% are abstaining, and the state average is 90%. And then again, we're above the state average for students who abstain from vape and e-cigarette. And then finally, with our 11th graders, 78% are abstaining, and the state average is 81%. So again, in our 11th grade, we are below the state average. Same thing with vape and e-cigarette device use. It will be interesting over the course of the next several times that we administer this survey to see what happens with the vape and e-cigarette use. One other interesting point is that the California Healthy Kids data shows a drop in San Luis Coastal in recent on-campus use or under the influence of alcohol and marijuana over the past 17 years. So in 99, we were sitting at 5%, and now we're less than 2% in 2016, while the state average has remained roughly 6%. So we have gone down over the years in the number of students reporting that they've been under the influence on campus. And now connectivity to school. And we consider this really important. And I think you'll see we've got a couple of principals who are going to be talking to you. We've spent a lot of time and energy making sure that our kids feel connected to school. So here's our 7th grader, and this is really impressive data among our middle schools. The last three surveys show a steady increase in student connectivity to school. The state average is 51%, while we're sitting at 72%. It's a huge difference. Going on to the next slide, our 9th grade students are not as connected as our 7th graders, but still show an impressive rate. State average is 44%, while we're at 56%. And then if you move to our 11th grade have been on a steady but slight decline since 2012. But even among our 11th grade students, the low connectedness is flatlined at the bottom. So we really are sitting around, 7 to 10% on the low end. The kids are hovering right around medium and high connectivity, and we do surpass the state average. And then finally here, this is the last piece of data we have for you. This is the average difference between the percentage of white students with high degrees of school connectivity versus the percentage of Hispanic Latino students with high degrees of school connectivity. We'd obviously like this number to be lower. And what we're seeing here is from 2010 through 16, we've got an increase in the number of Latinos who are showing that they are not as connected to the school as their white counterparts are reporting. The state average is at 8%. This is something that we take seriously. All of our administrators take this seriously. Right now we're just reporting 7, 9, and 11. If you go on to the next slide, Kim, you'll see that across the board, our schools are looking at connecting Latinos to the school. But just to highlight a couple of programs we have, at Morro Bay High, the Latina Youth Leadership Conference, Morro Bay High collaborated with a Latina sorority at Cal Poly and put on a Latina Youth Leadership Conference at Cal Poly. At SLO High, they had a Hispanic Latino Celebration Day, and this was the second annual of that. They hosted over 100 people, students and families. Welcome to the school. They had general educators there, administrators, counselors, all in an effort to further connect our Latino community to our schools. And then the next slide. Chris, I think you were going to talk a little bit about this School Climate Index report and then introduce our principals who are presenting.
So this is a brand new report that Healthy Kids Survey started putting out, or WestEd, who administers the California Healthy Kids Survey. They put this out back in the 2014 administration. And what it does is it takes all the information from the Healthy Kids Survey and it puts it into a general measurement called the School Climate Index. And our schools in general are notable in their school climate index, but in particular, our middle schools are extraordinarily notable in that they are in the top percentile of all schools in the state, and in addition, all like schools. So similar to the old API measurement, they measure it to all schools in the state and then to similar schools. So the similar school ranking and the state school ranking are in the top percentile in the entire state. So I thought it would be appropriate for our middle school principals to come up and talk a little bit and highlight some programs that they think are making them so exceptional in this regard. So let's start. Andre?
Good evening, everybody. A little under the weather here, but I'm happy to share about our school connectivity here at Los Osos Middle School. So at Los Osos Middle School, we've seen a significant surge in the student connectedness to school. And over the past 2 years, we have introduced multiple programs that has greatly contributed to this. Our restorative approach program, which Mrs. Frost talked about a little bit earlier, was introduced school-wide 2 school years ago through our advisory classes. Students were explicitly taught how to form a class circle and have an open, respectful discussion to help restore and maintain learning environment. This modality has given our students a voice to not only be heard, but also leaves each student valued and respected. Additionally, we instituted the 4 R's at Los Osos Middle School: respect, responsibility, and we also added in repair and reintegration. This explicitly teaches students what expectations are in each setting, not only how to behave, but also how to repair or reintegrate if things go awry. Lastly, in each of our academic classes, we instituted an outstanding citizenship rubric. This serves as a contract between the student and his or her teacher, clearly delineating what steps is needed for a student to demonstrate outstanding citizenship. Through this program, students are invited to advocate for themselves and have an in-depth, individual conversation with each of their teachers as they reflect on their behaviors and what it means for them to be a Los Osos Middle School student. A common theme really comes from each of these programs, and that is that students are connected to the school through avenues that provide a voice for students where they feel valued, they can have a respectful conversation, and a partnership with the adults on campus. Thank you.
I brought my timer. because I will go on. So at Laguna Middle School, we've seen a great increase in our student connectivity to school, and we've really focused in 3 major areas: the community, the classroom, and then the whole campus. And for the community, we really start our getting students acclimated to the school before they come in. With our 6th grade parent night and our 6th grade tour, we focus on dispelling the myths about middle school that parents and kids are afraid of. By doing that, we make parents happier. With parents happier and less stressed out about it, their kids come in less stressed out about it. This year, with the beginning of school, we also started the web program, which gave kids a really fun way to start school prior to their first day, which actually made our registration day much, much easier. We also have a newsletter that we do every week that informs and celebrates the things that are going on at our school. So parents always have information about what's going on at school. Even if it's bad, we'll bring it up in the newsletter, talk about it frankly. but it really is a great opportunity for us to celebrate what's going on. On the campus, biggest change has probably been what Scott and I like to call lifeguarding, not busting. Lifeguarding, we look for the difference between splashing and drowning. Splashing is okay, drowning is bad. When you're at a middle school, there's a lot of splashing. Sometimes you have to sit back and watch to make sure the splashing is not drowning. Once it's not drowning, you move on. We've also implemented the restorative approach, though Scott and I are listening to loans going, oh, we need to do that, and we need to do that too. We really encourage problem solving among the kids. We've also really tried to, when we're implementing new policies, keep them student-focused, not adult-focused, looking at it through the lens of what do we want our kids to be doing? How is this better for the kids? If it's just good for the adults and it's more convenient, maybe it's not something that we need to do. And we work to create kid-friendly spaces. We've got a great intramural program at lunch. We've got a phenomenal library and a librarian who makes our campus a wonderful place. And then lastly, in the classroom, one of the things that we've implemented is everybody talks in every classroom. That's made a huge change on our campus because all of our students are taught how to talk in the classroom. All of them are given practice talking with sentence frames. It gives the students an opportunity to be heard by their fellow students, by their teachers, and it really levels that playing field of kids coming into class expecting to speak and expecting to be heard. That carries on into other areas of our campus. We love our kids. That's evident. It's always been evident, but I think we celebrate more in the newsletter now and really put it out there. So we have a policy on our campus that there are no SEPs, no somebody else's problem. Every kid is everybody's concern. And we try to stay student-focused, again, not adult-focused, in the classroom. We look at what are kids doing? Who's in charge of their learning? How are we giving them something important for them to be doing? Because when they feel like they're doing something important, they take better care of our school and each other. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
That gives you a little glimpse of the results that we received through our California Healthy Kids survey this year, but I think also at trend lines over the last few years. I think it's important to look at those. While we gave you a glimpse, please also know that our site principals have all of the data, and they have all of the data for their site. You saw 11th graders across all high schools, 7th graders across two middle schools. They have data for their own site so they can sit down with their teams, their administrators, their counselors, their teachers, and talk about concerns and talk about celebrations and make plans to improve the scores, to make sure our kids are more connected, to make sure our kids are not using substances to the best of our ability. We're able to answer questions if you'd like. I know Jill, Chris will join me at the mic if you have any specific ones.
Mr. Unger.
So one of the things we know is that the new state accountability system will require a school climate score. But there hasn't been any agreement on that yet. Some people have suggested that the California Healthy Kids survey be used, but I think it's a district choice. Is that not true, Mr. Buckman?
I think it may be.
Yeah. So, have we been giving thought to how we might address student climate in our LCFF and our LCAP stuff?
Well,
our state accountability stuff, actually.
Right. We do have school climate through our culture of care.
Okay.
So we do set goals in that area. So even outside of the California Healthy Kids, I think that's a goal of this district. Look at the culture of care on each campus.
And the other thing I'm just wondering, I think that it's possible on this survey to add additional questions for specific districts. Is that true?
I know
we thought about that. Is there anything we're interested in that we're doing or that we haven't done, Chris?
There's different modules that you can add on. So like this year, we had a module for free that was piloted with our schools, and you can do add-on modules for different costs. So you can do those sort of things. In terms of like particular questions, I haven't seen that section for design your own question yet. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I just haven't seen it.
Mr. Quasimiri.
Chris, is this still a very lengthy survey? It used to be, 50 items or something like that.
Oh, it's more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very lengthy. And the reports are very thorough and comprehensive. So there's a large demographic section, there's a large safety section, there's a large social-emotional connectivity section, there's a large drug and alcohol and tobacco section. It's I'm not sure how many questions, but I could say it's probably expanded over 150 to 200 questions.
Okay, thank you.
And following up on that, Chris, are the scores disaggregated by subgroups? Can we see?
Not in all areas. So in some of these cases, I'm composing the data. I'm combining data so that it makes sense, because the way it's all laid out very individually. So in terms of each question has its own rating, so I'm trying to do composite data to make it digestible and more informative in that way. But disaggregation is only in certain sections, not in every section. So they've just started asking about LGBTQ students identifying, and they don't disaggregate by that category. They disaggregate in some categories by gender and in some cases by ethnicity, but it doesn't cross-correlate. So just because they do it in one category doesn't mean that WestEd will do it in another category. So oftentimes the biggest problem I have in looking at this data is disaggregating it and making it meaningful.
And just to say, in the past, first of all, it's my understanding that there's a companion piece to this that would be a staff climate. And do we do that as well?
Yeah, we do the school climate, and that's actually called the school climate survey for whatever reason, and the staff take that. It cross-correlates in some questions, but not all the questions cross-correlate, and the reporting is very distinctly different, so it's really hard to compare the two surveys because it's like apples and oranges. To make them line up, and I tried really hard for this presentation to make them line up because I anticipated that question. You know, how does the staff perceive these issues? But it's like comparing, you know, apples and oranges.
So
it's very difficult, but it is a standalone survey set that does ask some of the exact same questions, but from a staff perspective.
Okay. Thank you.
Mrs. Sheffer.
I just have a quick question about the way the test is constructed or the survey is constructed. I'm assuming it's a bubble survey.
It's online now.
Okay. So and is there any opportunity for the survey taker to add anything, or
I read the reports. I don't take the survey, but I read the reports, and there's no generalized narrative section to the reports. So that's a difficult area to capture because there's probably context and substance that could be added through a narrative section, but it's not asked in this survey as far as I can tell.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And I guess my comment would be that as we look at the student safety, the wellness portion of it, the drugs, alcohol, and tobacco portions of it, because the connectivity, we definitely do see that we're making strides in connectivity. But with regard to the others, when we find ourselves a percentage or two above the state average, I don't consider that something to applaud, given that across the state, we have schools with guards and much higher concentrations of poverty and gang behaviors that we are not experiencing. You know, in our schools, it seems to me that we should be striving to and hoping to find ourselves many more percentage points above the state average than we're currently finding ourselves.
I would add a bit of context to that. In those areas around marijuana, alcohol, and tobacco use, the query is in regards to lifetime use. And so that doesn't ask anything in relation to on-school campus or on-school grounds. It's about students that have used outside, oftentimes, or most of the time, outside the bounds and scope of school. So there's a lot of factors that weigh into a student's proclivity towards experimenting with drugs or using drugs and alcohol that we're probably losing some control of as they get older, and I think you see that in the data. I'd say this is probably a community issue as much as it is a school issue, but I would agree
with
that sentiment that it's concerning when you look at the 11th grade data uniformly being below the state average in abstinence from tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana.
Yeah, we certainly want to applaud our successes, but we need to acknowledge areas for growth as well.
Absolutely.
And I'd agree with you, and I think Chris would as well, that we would like to be far more over the state average than we see. And I think that was kind of indicative of that slide we showed you about VAERS, safe versus safe. Combined, we have great scores, but we'd really like to see ourselves in the top
very
tier
safe.
Far more than we are right now. So we agree with you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Quesenberry.
So, because this is a lengthy survey and it's now computerized, does this this is given during the instructional day and in an instructional period? Is it usually in English classes at the secondary level?
I believe so.
Okay.
And certainly administrator choice. I think they generally choose the content area.
And it's given to all the kids in that grade level. Do they have the opportunity to continue it if they don't finish it within a certain amount of time? Does it allow them to go back and pick up where they left off?
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm wondering. I've never had an issue that kids go through it in the time allotted.
It's usually pretty, they go through it pretty quickly. In my experience, Scott, it goes. It takes about a half hour to administer. Okay.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thanks, Scott. Thank
you.
I guess I have one more question. And this would be for the administrators, just nods of heads or shows of hands. The people administering the survey, do you have the feeling that the students are taking it seriously? Heads are nodding yes. Across the board. Okay, thank you. Mr. Unger.
So just, Marilyn, your question actually spurred something I was thinking about. I'm looking at the marijuana use in lifetime. You know, I'm not suggesting that the numbers don't bear improvement, but I think it is interesting if we look at ninth grade, we have the red line is 1 to 3 times over your lifetime. Then by 11th grade, 2 years later, it's 4 or more times over your lifetime. So a student who was in that red zone could quite easily cross over into the yellow zone within 2 years by, you know, smoking a reefer or being around friends that get high one more time. It's good information. I'm not sure how valuable it is, as I think Mr. Dowler was talking about. The other thing I'd be also curious more to find out more about is safe versus very safe and what that means. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you say it's
right.
I'm safe versus I'm very safe? It's like when I get the survey question from Ralph's and it says,
right.
Are you uber satisfied with our prices, or are you satisfied with our prices? You know,
it seems to be set up like on a Likert scale. So you have very safe, safe,
okay.
Neither, unsafe, very unsafe. So it isn't distinguished between what constitutes safe versus very safe. So again,
uh-huh.
It's a dipstick. It's a moment in
right.
time, and it's a feeling at that given moment for a student that
they
report.
Probably the more important thing is the students that are saying they don't feel safe. I think it's harder to differentiate between very safe and safe versus a kid that's coming out and saying, I just don't feel safe here.
Right. I really like that our schools, when it gets down to reportable acts of violence, I like to see that number of students not experiencing violence going up. I like to see those numbers of students feeling connected to school going up.
Right.
Those are the sort of trend lines over time that you want to see. So one given year data set isn't very informative, but when you look at that along a trend line, you see steady improvement in
Thank
those
you.
Areas.
Yeah, it's hard to, or I don't know how you would differentiate on a study like this between a student who has a fear that they might be trash canned and therefore doesn't feel totally safe because that fear exists for them. as opposed to a student who has actually experienced an incident and therefore doesn't feel safe.
One really fascinating, actually, piece of data that this is me nerding out on this a little bit, but one thing that really jumped out at me is while you have a steady increase in the amount of students saying they have not experienced any acts of violence on school, and that trend line goes up over the last 11 years significantly, you do not have a corresponding increase in students feeling safe. In fact, you have a kind of a little, just these little tiny movements up and down through the years. So while kids are reporting being actually safer at school, they're not saying they feel much safer. And that to me is real, because it's perception more than reality.
Yeah, it's like the fear of having to shower at middle school. It never really comes true, but it remains a fear going in. And we may be seeing some of that, you know, at the high school level as well.
Yeah.
Can I just make one comment?
Certainly. Dr. Eisengrath Rogers.
I love the sound of the restorative circle, the repair and reintegration, I think you said, Mr. Lake. And I think maybe that speaks, Chris, to what you were saying, is that we don't know whether these students are actually experiencing these things or they have a fear of experiencing them or whether they experience them and they're over it. And so maybe what we'll be able to see as these circles continue is more confidence in that happened to me, I dealt with it, I'm moving on. So good job on that.
Okay, I see no Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Over the years, the California Healthy Kids Survey has been playing a bigger role at both the state level, the county, and in local school districts in helping to set policy. And it seems to be the focus for a lot of the questions that are on here and a way for the districts, school boards to get data. So I know there's a lot more out there than this great summary. So I'm hoping that I can get a copy, but also maybe that there's an opportunity for us to either hear more. And I don't know if this is a future agenda item or not.
We can provide more data to you if you'd like that.
Yeah.
I'm happy to provide for you all the reports on all the schools, the district, the county, the state. It can be a little overwhelming.
The district would be interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Go
ahead.
Is the survey provided in other languages than English?
I believe it's provided also in Spanish, and I don't know about other languages. But
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much for the presentation.
And principals.
Oh, and principals, thank you for your presentations and all of the staff that's with us tonight. Thank you for joining us. Moving on, we have correspondence. At the time the agenda was posted, no correspondence had been received. Did any board member receive correspondence they'd like to share? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to public comment. It doesn't appear that we've received any formal requests to speak, but is there anyone present who would like to address the board during public comment? Okay, seeing no one, will move on then to superintendent's updates, business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
There goes. Just a quick couple of things. We had our auditors were here last week, kind of going through the books, meeting with both myself and Julie Lang. Everything seemed like smooth, fine. They will be coming back to hopefully actually present early this year. It looks like potentially the end of November. So that's kind of their plan to do both the Measure D audit presentation to the board as well as our normal school district audit. We had a great meeting today covering the Affordable Care Act over at the County Office of Education, kind of talking about the potential of the Cadillac tax in 3 years. And it's one of those things where you know, for people to understand that when something like the Affordable Care Act happens, there's so much paperwork and things that mandates that are put on the district to have to follow up with, and you know, all the paperwork for if they have insurance, if they don't, and what kind, and is it affordable. And so my point of bringing it up is kudos to our staff in both personnel and the fiscal office that have had to take on these additional tasks due to the legislation that's come forward. And it's, you know, it's like the critical time where it happens right at the beginning of the – in January, right when W-2s and everything else are going on. So it's just an interesting thing. And as I read through all of the bills that the governor approved today and those that he vetoed, many of those bring on additional tasks to the district. So mandates, things that we have to do and keep up on. And it seems like it just never ends, that list of what districts have to do to keep up with all those things. So wanted to kind of relay that. And then lastly, reading school services article recently, UCLA does their kind of annual forecast of the economy, and it looks like they're predicting kind of a slowdown in both the U.S. and the California economy for this year. So where they were talking 3% growth early on, now it's about 1.5%. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic, I think, for both California as well as the United States as we enter into the election season and what's going to happen there. And then I think afterwards, I think we're going to, kind of see one way or the other, kind of the path, whether we're going to hit a recession or if we're going to kind of stay stable during that, over the next 6 months to a year.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Educational services update, Mr. Robinette.
I believe you'll be hearing enough from me in future items, so I have nothing to report unless you have questions for me.
I see none. Measure D update. Again, Mr. Pinkerton, I believe.
Yeah, so just quickly, just a reminder to the board that actually not this Friday, but the following, we have our next study session where I'm going to be going over the kind of based on our current estimates and projections from our projects. We have a much better kind of view of the overall scope of cost, in particular with San Luis Obispo High School and Morro Bay High School. So I'll be reviewing all of that kind of projection with the board to kind of let you kind of see the new picture of where we're at in those discussions with all of our projects. We'll also be going over three kind of critical projects and sharing those designs with you. That is the J-Wing building, which is the kind of CTE complex at Morro Bay High School, the Student Support Center, which is kind of the front new office, career center, counseling center, all of the office spaces that's going to then lend itself to more classroom space on the campus. So we'll go over that. And then we'll also be looking at the annex, which is the 12 new classroom building for San Luis Obispo High School, and potentially the Performing Arts Center, new Student Support Center for SLO High as well. So some key ones that we're ready to begin to move on and hopefully get board approval to get those through with DSA and get those started in the summer of 17. So coming up quickly. Other than that, we had a great CBOC meeting. Citizens Bond Oversight, we went over kind of all the expenditures for the year, so they'll be providing a report later to the board on those expenditures, and then we visited SLO High School. It was great to go into those two model classrooms at SLO High and to talk. We actually, the CBOC got to talk to the kids. Mr. Miner was nice enough to let us to do that, and we're going to see this as the bond projects progress, but I'm telling you, the impact that it will have on students and the way they feel about school, kind of like these surveys, will be dramatic. So the way those kids felt about those new classrooms, just two on a campus, was really interesting to hear their perceptions and what they thought. So Mrs. Sheffer was there and got to hear that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, seeing none, then we'll move on. The next item is a public hearing. Determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. Mrs. McGrath.
Good evening. Tonight I'm pleased to report that we have gathered information around the sufficiency of textbooks and materials, and the district is sufficient in all areas. So at this time I would ask that we open this topic for a public hearing in order to allow for community input, and a resolution could be presented to the board for action on October 18th if you wish.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a
Yes, Mr. Miller.
Chris just was wondering, is this the first time we've been in adequate textbooks without any caveats or anything? No? Okay.
Maybe so.
All right. Error of central tendency.
Okay, then I am opening a public hearing on the determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials. And I see no one coming to speak to that topic, so I will close the public hearing. Thank you very much. We'll revisit this at the next board meeting. Okay, discussion items. 9.01, the LCAP Outreach Plan. Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. We have an old social science teacher here, so I should get my clicker. The Mississippi River is the largest river in North America. It is one of our nation's greatest cultural and geographical landmarks. It goes through or borders 19 states. It's fed by tributaries from the Rockies to the Appalachians and actually in some way touches 31 of the 48 continental states. It meanders relatively slowly all the way from Minnesota down to the Gulf of Mexico, spilling out thousands of gallons per second in about a 2,300-mile curved route. But when you view it from a distance, if you go up in space and look at the Mississippi, it looks like a straight line that divides our country east and west. All the rivers that flow into the Mississippi are really different and unique and have their own speeds and meanderings. So the Missouri, the Tennessee, the Ohio, the Yellowstone, the Osage, there's many of the major river systems in the world flow into the Mississippi. But once they're part of Old Man River, they have a solid path. And I believe that essentially all school districts in the state, in the nation, are essentially following the same direction. We are all following a similar path. I believe everyone in every community is seeking greater student achievement for their kids. They all want students to graduate career and college ready. They all want a flow that ensures a solid future for their local communities. And they all want children to attend school in a safe and nurturing environment. But we are also a bunch of tributaries. There are over 1,100 school districts in California, for example. And they all feed that single river of student achievement. Maybe it isn't working. So I've worked for six different superintendents in my career, and one of the things that if you can just click the next one here, we'll get off of all my timing. One of the things that happens is superintendents come into school districts and usually enter into mission statements and visioning projects and strategic plans, and Dr. Prater is no exception. When he came into the district, he looked around, and we initiated the student strategic initiatives for student success. And his mantras have stayed with us over these last 6.5 years of all means all. We hear that all the time in our cabinet meetings, that make sure that everything we're doing is leaving no student behind, and that the classroom is the center of our focus, that everything we do needs to hit the classroom floor, that first-time instruction is the most valuable thing we do. A few years ago, if you click the next one there, we got something called the Local Control Accountability Plan handed to us, which was actually pretty easy for us because it was a new way of figuring out how we were going to be accountable with our resources through the governor's local control funding formula. And the rules were pay attention to your local community, but also pay attention to those groups of students that includes EL students, homeless, foster youth, and those socioeconomically disadvantaged, but be responsive to your local community. It blended perfectly with our strategic plans for student success or strategic initiatives for student success. But just like a river's flow changes with weather conditions, snow melt, dams and levees, so does the conditions of a school district when the economic landscape changes. The impending closure of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant will dam up a resource flow to our movement towards student achievement. And believe me, we'll still be on that same path and that same river. Tonight I want to just suggest that we believe that the confluence of these things, the fact that we have this LCAP that we have to do every year, and that it has to do with our budget planning and how we're going to align our resources, actually presents itself at a time that is that we can take full advantage of the same questions and the same outreach efforts that we need to do with our Diablo Canyon closure. In other words, why don't we try to accomplish the task of figuring out what it is that's most important to our school district as we define our local control accountability at the same time that we are also figuring out what to do with this diminishing of resources over time? Because really both are asking us to focus on three things. Put our focus on students. We do have a clear path, and no matter what happens with our resources, we are focusing on all kids. Secondly, we need to seek input. It's part of the LCAP. It's part of what we need to do in anything that has to do with potential budget cuts, is we need to get the input of our stakeholders. And lastly, the job, perhaps the primary job of the Board of Education, is to align resources, align expenditures with revenue to make sure that we are paying attention to those very things. So I just want to point out some of the things that are happening already and that I think will actually combine efforts in both our LCAP and our Diablo Canyon closure recommendations. We have five community forums that have been set up where we will be harvesting interest from employees and community members. These begin on October 26th. They run through November. And then we will have two follow-up meetings after the superintendent announces his suggested budget cuts for at least the first year of what we need to face as we look at Diablo Canyon. So we have a perfect opportunity already to be getting feedback from many of our stakeholders. In addition, Dr. Prater has formed a local leaders group made up of civic, business, education, and nonprofit leaders in the community that'll be meeting twice to provide feedback on district direction. We also will plan on doing extensive online surveying of staff and parents as part of our closure budgeting and always as part of our LCAP plan. Then we have student outreach. It's required in the LCAP, but also it's something we really want to get a handle on how our students feel about their school district and the kinds of things we should be doing or looking at. Dr. Prater is organizing a superintendent student senate made up of a group of high school students from each of our two comprehensive high schools and our continuation high school, and a separate group of middle school students that will not just meet one time in a one-off meeting, but will actually meet over the course of the school year two or three times so that they can provide information, go back to their school sites with some homework perhaps to kind of ask other students and provide some questions that we can then glean information back. So I think the student outreach is going to be very robust this year. Lastly, we have parent groups, and there are specific groups that are required in the LCAP, and obviously we'll be reaching out to these groups not only with our local control accountability plan, but with ideas about the potential closure and the impacts in the school district. This would be our DLAC, our District English Language Advisory Group, our Title I advisory called the DTAC, and our PTA parent advisory group that Dr. Prater meets with monthly. We believe that by combining these efforts when appropriate, we will not be working at cross purposes. Sometimes some of these things we'll have to have different meetings just for LCAP or feedback, but others for feedback on the Diablo situation. But we think we can also preserve some staff time in not doing double duty and not raise expectations of what we will do with LCAP while at the same time seeing a potential diminishment of resources. The local control accountability plan will again be presented in two public meetings in May with an adoption that coincides with the 2017-18 budget in the first meeting of June, and we'll just keep rolling along. And so our request tonight is to allow us to kind of
as appropriate, combine the efforts that we're going to be doing with public outreach and community outreach and student outreach and parent outreach on these two big items that are facing the school district. And I'm available for questions or comments.
Mr. Beckman.
Thanks, Rick. This is always, the district has always gone above and beyond what the state has asked us when we involve the community. When I look at the specific groups, I know that we have school site councils at each of the schools, and I'm wondering about involvement because that's a different segment. And I don't know if we've done that in the past, Dr. Prater. I know you've met with more people than the state requires.
Specifically, I've not met with the school site councils, but through the principals. Mm-hmm. They have gathered their feedback and brought it to principal council meetings for good. Sharing. But specifically, I have not met with site councils at all the sites. Okay. That's a good idea.
And to add to your burden, I have a second question. The Student Senate that's being put together, mm-hmm. The concept is just phenomenal to me. But the choice of students and ensuring that, I don't know how else to put it, the same old suspects.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just the, that everybody gets a shot at it. So are you going to be working towards that as well?
Yeah, that was exactly what we were trying to avoid, the usual suspects. You know, part of our ritual in our district office is we have our principals present their school plan, their school vision and focus for the year to our executive cabinet team. And so we've really enjoyed that process, and it's happening right now as we speak. So last week we met with the secondary principals, and I requested that they avoid the trap of giving me students that will just give me a one-dimensional sort of set of feedback. So there, I specifically requested they think about it. They provide me with 8 to 10 students that represent the cross-section of their school, that are thoughtful, that are in it for all the right reasons, and but are prepared to commit to not just coming to a meeting with me and my team, but actually going back with some deeper questions that need to be answered. And so this will be a process that I think I'm experimenting with it this year, that I think will provide us with, I think, authentic and a level of depth of information that we have not had before. So I'm excited about it. I will look forward to seeing how that all turns out.
And so they would bring together some of the students with all the right stuff, and I'm hoping we get some of the students with a little bit that's the wrong stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, I imagine we'll get it all.
Yeah, I think I'm wondering, would this Student Senate, is that what it's being called?
As of right now, that's what it's being called.
Okay.
I played around with different acronyms, but you know how we educators are. We love our acronyms. But
okay, well, that one works for me. I'm just wondering if that would be taking the place of the student LCAP outreach that we did last year. Because I know I was there for a couple of those sessions, and it was designed to be, and what we spoke with were a group of students that represented a real cross-section of the student body, from those less engaged to those highly engaged and everybody in between.
Yeah, and it was super meaningful. And mm-hmm. I know a number of board members participated and were able to listen in on the feedback. What I learned in reflection was that I wasn't convinced that I was getting the whole story, nor was I convinced I was getting necessarily the accurate view over time. So I'm experimenting with this 4 times in the year. October, I think I have it scheduled. Kim Holmes and I were working on dates today. But October, December, February, and March. And after each of those sessions, there will be homework to go back. And the principals will help assist with that. And that way, I think when people go, when students leave a conversation with me with a set of questions to then ask their peer group, and then they're supposed to synthesize that and bring it back to me, I think we're going to get a different set of data. And I look forward to seeing it. I think we're going to be pleased with it. And I'm sure, to Mr. Buckman's point, I'm sure we're going to hear some things we don't particularly like. But isn't that the point of the LCAP, is to figure out what's not working and address it? And that's what we're after here. And I think this system, this new superintendent student senate for action system, will I think help us get to that place of deepening our data set.
Thank you.
One more quick one.
Sure.
So we meet with the LCAP groups. They give us input in the outreach groups, and then we implement the LCAP through the wonderful Ryan and his team, and come up with the LCAP report. And what I'm wondering is, do we have the opportunity, and maybe this is it if we start early enough, to give feedback on, oh, that suggestion you made was put into place, oh, and it was successful? Because it's great to keep asking for input, but I'm not sure whether everybody understands that it actually is put in place and whether it works.
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. We do take in a lot of information, and I believe we do fold much of that feedback into measurable action plans. But do we circle back to those groups to articulate, this is how we're addressing that feedback? I don't believe we've done that. And I know we haven't done that, because in my outreach to students last year, I was sitting next to a young lady at San Luis Obispo High School, and she didn't know I had supersonic ears, and she didn't know that I could hear her speaking to her friend who was sitting next to her, and she said, oh, I was here last year, and nothing got done. This is a waste of time. Well, I couldn't help myself. I said, excuse me. I go, can you tell me what you mean? Because this is important to me. So what I think, you know, my adult reaction was, well, of course we were responsive. But if her perception was that we weren't, then that's important to know, which means how do we circle back with our action plans and provide at least some detailed steps as to the students that we asked, took the time to ask, as to what we plan and intend to do. So that would be a thorough and, I think, respectful approach this time around.
If I may also add, I think, at least from my perspective, the idea of harvesting interest and feedback in wherever we're going is a way of actually addressing that. These community forums that were originally intended for the impending Diablo closure, I think, will be largely educational for our community. I mean, our hope is that we can actually present, this is what our school district looks like. This is what we do. As I did at the last meeting, this is what professional development looks like in San Luis Coastal in this meeting. This is what our programs and services are, so that we can actually provide substance in those meetings and then gather responses based on those substance and on our results. So I think that hopefully this will actually help to get to that very thing, Mr. Buckman.
Okay, then, seeing no additional board comment, Mr. Robinette, thank you for that presentation. I believe you have the next one as well.
And I'm assuming that you're okay with us sort of combining efforts in this outreach. General consensus in that, I'm hoping.
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so.
Okay.
Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant Closure Impact Report Number 4.
Right. Thank you. Mrs. Holmes is she anticipated every one of my clicks, so we'll hopefully this will work again. At the last meeting, We presented, we have an ongoing presentation at virtually every board meeting until the superintendent makes his recommendation on some of the impacts of the potential of what's going to happen for a basic aid district. And at the last meeting, we talked about how in a basic aid district, which is a district that receives dollars over and above what most receive, we talked about professional development and the fact that we are very proud of the professional development efforts. We believe it's made a significant difference in student achievement. The purpose tonight is to talk about programs and services, so the number two bullet on there, and some of those things that we do that are over and above in this area. Districts have great similarities and differences, and often these have to do with the types of programs and services offered that are above the basics. The basics might just be a teacher in a classroom with a certain number of students teaching a prescribed curriculum for a period of time. But there are things we do that that look very much different than other districts, and there are things that look very much the same no matter where you go. Because we have funds as a basic aid district, I would argue that our ability to do special things is more robust than in most school districts. But before I start listing a bunch of those things, I think I want to be sure to explain what this is not. This is representative. It's not exhaustive. I'm sure that any of us can sit and think of myriad of other programs and services that aren't going to be mentioned here. I also want to make sure that it's really clear this is not a cut list. As I presented last week about professional development, it wasn't assuming that all professional development goes away because of Diablo Canyon. We can surmise that these are some of the things, some of the areas that we will need to scrutinize as we contemplate aligning our resources with our expenditures, but in no way is this a suggestion that this is the stuff that the superintendent's going to recommend to the board to go away. And this is not a list of things we apologize for. I think that's really important, too. We've had a largesse that has helped us to be a great school district, and we believe that it's because of these very things that has made us a better place for our children and our community. So in no particular order. We have PE and music at the elementary level taught by specialists. So this provides preparation for our elementary teachers, which is part of our contractual agreement and very important. But it's also one of those areas where we are actually able to get credentialed single subject physical education teachers, credentialed single subject music teachers that offer these programs for our students. Transportation. There is no state requirement to transport students to and from school. Home to school is not a requirement unless a student has an IEP that is part of their individual plan to get to school. However, we as a school district and many school districts provide transportation, and we provide transportation at all levels, elementary, middle, and high school, and we also provide transportation anywhere in our communities to our two elementary magnet programs, Pacheco and Teach Elementary. We have school resource officers. These are contracts that we pay for out of our local control accountability plan to have police officers from the city of San Luis Obispo and the city of Morro Bay at our high school campuses. These are contracted services. We also have our own campus security officers on our campuses. We have a wonderful preschool system in our school district. Preschool is not required by any means of a K-12 district. However, we believe that this has been a significant thing for our school district. We have four preschools operating in our school district. We receive no Head Start federal funds or state preschool funds. This is our attempt to reach those gap students who would not normally be able to go to preschool. And we think it's been wildly successful. We also have a cooperative preschool that is run by our adult school that is an opportunity for parents to attend with their children on a more regular basis than our parent participation program. And these programs also provide great mainstreaming opportunities for our special education students who are pre-K. We spend money on technology in our school district. We are getting very close to fulfilling our mission of one-to-one computers for our students and Wi-Fi'd up our entire school district. And we also spend a considerable amount of money on technology, software, and licenses for personalized learning. You've heard some of those presentations about Myon or Read 180 or programs that we have ongoing licenses with to provide individualized opportunities for students. We also spend money on career technical education. We've been very fortunate over the years with things like Perkins grants and Ag incentive, but more recently with a real boon of CTE dollars coming into the school district, where we are able to purchase materials in our career technical education classes that really emulate the workplace, so that students in auto mechanics, for example, are working with modern machines and computers and the things they would need to be able to go into those trades. We have two family resource centers, one operating in Los Osos and one in the city of San Luis Obispo. Originally, these were conceived as drop-in centers. We found them to be far better to just be office spaces where community resources can come to and people can make appointments and come to the resource centers for all types of issues, especially for our socioeconomically disadvantaged, our foster and homeless youth. We also have family advocates that work in all of our schools to plug students and families into needed resources such as housing and gas cards and food and clothing and school supplies. So these work in conjunction, these family advocates work in conjunction with our school counselors and our principals at all of our sites. We run a district print shop, probably one of the few that still have our own internal copy center where we can have all of our own forms made and available and also be able to have a service to our schools to get all of their printing needs met internally. We have English language learner teachers or English learner teachers and aides throughout our school district. We have a large chunk of those at Pacheco Elementary, but all throughout our school district we have EL teachers and aides that do push in and pull out services. We also have other people who are involved in intervention at all of our schools. Athletics is an interesting one. I remember when we were contemplating budget cuts in 2001, the community would say, well, athletics has nothing to do with K-12. We'll just wipe that off of the books. And it was an interesting concept because it is extracurricular, truly. But we have a very robust athletic program. The board authorized just last year additional stipends for coaches at the middle school level and an expansion of our middle school sports program. And we have CIF-sanctioned sports at all levels. If we have the interest, we have freshman-level sports, which doesn't always exist in other districts. We have an AVID program. Acceleration via Individual Determination is what the acronym stands for. AVID is a program originally intended for high school students. There's a middle school and even an elementary component. But we have it alive and well at our high schools where it's intended to help students who are first generation or potential first generation college students. So students whose parents did not have the opportunity or did not take advantage of going to college, and this is intended to get those students to a four-year university. Very successful. And we provide extra sections to our schools to have the AVID program. We have counseling at all levels at our school district, high school, middle school, and elementary school. The ratios at the high school are probably average, about normal. Middle schools, where we are probably a pretty high ratio of counselor to student, and at the elementary school, where counseling is somewhat unusual, we still have it in place. In addition to counseling, we have contracts with mental health therapists at all of our sites. So we actually have marriage, family, child, either interns or fully licensed MFCC people who provide services at our school sites with referrals. We have summer school, and summer school in our school district serves remediation, intervention, credit recovery, and original credit at the elementary, middle, and high school level. This district has had a long commitment to early literacy. We've had an extremely highly respected and successful reading recovery program for many years. This is the last year of that program. We've actually been fading out reading recovery because it's expensive. It's one-to-one instruction for first grade students. We've replaced it largely with another intervention, level literacy instruction, which is basically 3-to-1 or sometimes smaller or larger groups of students with a highly trained teacher for early literacy intervention for students struggling, because we know that's the one determiner of future success is the ability to read at a young age. And lastly but not leastly, we run an adult school in this school district, one of the largest adult schools in the Tri-Counties. It's kind of amazing when you think about it, because we serve almost as many adults as we do students in our school district through our adult education program. And I don't think we often realize how many types of interesting programs adult school runs, because we have various ways for adults to earn high school diplomas. We have an extensive parent education program and one of our kind of hallmark programs, parent participation, where we enable community people to connect with our school district by having a cooperative type of parent bring your child to a preschool, developmental preschool setting for infants and toddlers. We offer English as a second language. We offer literacy programs for adults. We teach in the jail for not only students to get a high school diploma, men or women who are in our county jail, but also vocational training. And almost all of this is self-paid or through grant funding. Our adult school runs on very little general fund, mostly just for the overhead. And there are probably other things that can be on this list, but I think it's apparent that we have a lot of great programs and services in our school district. And the question that we will be grappling with over the next few months is, if we know we're going to need to cut $8 to $12 million from our ongoing expenses, 14% to 20% of our budget, what programs and services will we need to rethink or actually eliminate in the future? And so with that, I'm available for any questions you may have.
Let me go to the public. Is there anyone from the public who would like to comment on this? Yes, please.
My name is Rita Rodriguez, and I'm the Hawthorne preschool teacher. And a couple of years ago, I came up to before the board, and I wanted to say how important preschool is. And it was important back then. It's still important now, maybe more so, especially in the future. One issue that was brought up earlier tonight is the positive behavior supports. Preschool is really when we start with those positive behavior supports. That's where most of the students learn social skills. They learn at a very young age. They learn language, how to express their thoughts and feelings in a positive way, and that not only is valid for preschool, but throughout the elementary and high school years as well. I know preschool is also expensive. However, I've been doing a little bit of research, and there are modifications that can be made. So for me, it's most important that in some format, preschool stays in this district. One point that I had made the first time that I spoke with you, I've been teaching preschool for 21 years. I've taught the Head Start level. I've taught at a private nonprofit. I've taught for the California State Preschool System and now with the district. And I have to say, out of those programs, this has been the most proactive, the most positive, and the most impactive programs. And the reason for that is that there's a link between the preschool and the elementary school. We're involved with the teacher collaboration time. I personally know what's expected of those students as they go into kindergarten, first, second grade. I'm a trained reading recovery teacher as well, an LLI teacher, which means that I have high expectations for my students. I want them to succeed not only in preschool, but as they continue their education. We're the foundation. We're building that foundation, and we want positive things for all of our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comment? Okay, seeing none, then I'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Unger.
I think one of the things I realized today in discussions I've had with teachers, and I shared this with Dr. Prater, is as we look at our school district over the next several years, if we look at what we're doing in terms of doing what we're doing now minus about $12 million, then we're probably not going to be able to be very successful. If we look at what can we do given the new reality, what is there that's out there, what can we do as a district, what can we do that's revolutionary, that's going to really make a difference in kids, recognizing that we're going to have $12 million less, I think that's a place for us to really have some conversations, rather than we're losing it and take it for what it is given the model we have now. I don't think we can continue to run the current model we have. And I think we, you know, I know it almost sounds trite, but I think we have some opportunities to look at different ways of doing things that might be equally successful for children.
Thank you. Any additional board comment? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Robinette. Item 9.03, Conflict of Interest Code, Amendment to Designated Filing Positions. Mrs. Holmes.
Thank you. We brought this to you last meeting as a public hearing so that you could have an opportunity for anyone in the public to look at this. Every 2 years, we bring the Conflict of Interest Code to you for revision or reaffirmation. And what we are presenting to you tonight is a simple change to the appendix that reports which of our employees are required to file those notices. And the changes are sort of tied to our work with Measure D. The people who have been added are already filing. The Assistant Director of Facilities and Operations and Transportation, who is Steve Stewart, was filing under his prior title. And the members of the Measure D Citizens Bond Oversight Committee have been added, and they all filed at the time that they joined that committee. So we're simply formalizing their role on the appendix. And if the board does approve this, then we'll submit this to the Board of Supervisors. They take official action on these documents for all of the reporting agencies in the county, and whatever change is made would become effective 30 days following that board's action.
Thank you. Mr. Millar.
I will move approval of the appendix as amended for bylaw 9270.
So we have a motion by Mr. Millar, a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So that passes 7-0. 9.04, Measure D change order approval process. Both Mr. Holcomb and Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, Mr. Holcomb is going to come and join me, and you better bring your computer with you, because I don't think you're going to be able to read that. You got it? All right, you're on your own. Yes, because I know I can't read it. So the board, at the beginning of the summer, we had a lot of summer projects upcoming. We knew that we weren't going to have a board meeting for a month and a half. And so with those summer projects, we did realize, hey, there could be some unforeseen conditions. There could be some things that came up during construction. The board went ahead and kind of approved, okay, Ryan, we grant you the authority to go ahead and keep these projects going over the course of the summertime, knowing full well that we were going to revisit this idea of how the change order process works and the potential of authorizing future kind of, granting me the ability to continue that process. So that's kind of what we're here tonight, is to review that again. I know Mr. Holcomb and Mr. Palazzo went through the change order process, the current change orders that we faced over the summer, kind of in depth. And so I'm going to go ahead and have Mr. Holcomb, just for the public's sake, kind of talk about change orders. Why would you have a change order? What happens, as well as the process? Because I want to make sure the board understands that there is a lengthy process before anything like a change, which is basically a change in the contract. So, we get the design goes out, we bid that work, we get a contractor on board, they begin the project. And so as the project goes, if there's a unforeseen condition or, hey, you know what, it would really be beneficial to the district to add a drain here or add a water meter at this spot or those types of things, what happens then? And so I'm going to have Mr. Holcomb kind of just talk about that with the board right now, and then we'll talk about the authorization.
Well, as we noted at our study session, there's a lot of things occur, especially in when you're on an old campus remodeling or even a relatively new campus. We've encountered conditions specifically at the San Luis Obispo High School tennis court project, where we had a high-pressure gas line. We found a giant cavern, which there's no way to anticipate those things. So those are called a field condition, and if you read the first box there, field condition is identified in the field by the architect, the engineer, the contractor, inspector of record, project manager, or if the district asks for additional scope. So that begins this process. It's defined by a drawing or a request for information or other direction that's provided to the contractor, and costs to perform the work are requested from that contractor. So we see a hole in the ground, and now that's kind of a poor example because we really can't say what does it cost to fill the hole because we don't know how big it is. So that kind of thing does occur, but we know it has to be filled. So when we're at about that stage, when we request cost, we also talk about the different methods within the contract language on how that contractor is to derive those costs that are presented to us. And there's oftentimes some disagreement at about that stage, and we simply say, please follow the contract. And that's been a bit of a problem. We have contractors who have bid a project, they sign the contract, we get to about this stage, and they say, well, gee, I didn't know that was in there. So I don't know how to help you if you didn't read your contract. So anyway, those conditions come up. Our project managers are trained, and we continue this training to direct them back to the contract. In fact, in our meeting today, we discussed that in the pre-bid conference, we should point that to them, point it out to them that here's how we handle changes to the contract. Would you please be aware of that? Kind of a due diligence on our part not to give false expectations based on what might have occurred in the past. Because in some districts, these things are a little loose, and good old Bill will say, I think it's about $5,000, and we say, oh, shucks, go ahead. And then it's $50,000, and everyone's surprised. But we have a specific procedure that our project managers are trained in to direct them back to the contract. And we have three different methodologies that we determine those costs. So that oftentimes takes place at this stage. So then the contractor submits his estimation of cost to perform the work as a potential or a proposed change order, PCO. The cost is reviewed by the project manager and the architect and the engineer for scope verification and unit pricing, if unit pricing is present in their contractually required schedule of values that they turn into us. So if we want an extra manhole and there's two manholes on their schedule of values and they're priced at $10,000 a piece, we say we want a third for $10,000 each, not $20,000, not any other figure. So that's the unit pricing suggested as one of the methodologies to determine price in our contract. Let me point out at about this stage that all of these arrows that you see going down kind of indicate it's an automatic process. Well, it isn't really. It's dynamic. So all of these arrows you could turn around and go back up because this stuff goes back and forth repeatedly and is massaged. And like you'll notice the next box, if it's accepted, the PCO is reviewed by the program advisor and the director and then forwarded to the assistant superintendent. But it's very ordinary, in fact, virtually always, that I know in my case and in Mr. Pinkerton's, that we're out there in the field at the genesis of anything significant. So we want to look at the hole in the ground. We want to see where that gas pipe is, because if you're ahead of that process, you're way, way ahead at guiding that process. So we don't wait for something to come all the way down to that little blue box. We're out there in advance looking. In fact, both Ryan and I today were at the tennis courts at Slo-High looking at some of those conditions. So if it's accepted, we review it, and then we send it back to the architect to turn into an official change order. And that change order under what we're proposing is approved by the assistant superintendent and then moves on to be ratified by the board. I sent one board member today the actual language out of the law that says even though we or Mr. Pinkerton may approve a change order after we review it, it really isn't binding on the district until it's ratified by the board. So a contractor, now you can't really, we can't bring it to you and you say, nah, we're not going to pay it. There are ramifications to that. However, pardon me? Only in the case of malfeasance is it, does it land on one of us. But no, it, then you would go into adjudication of some kind, whether it's litigation, arbitration, mediation, some form of adjudicating that number. So, and then if it's not accepted on the right-hand set of boxes, it's sent back to the contractor for revision. Very often we, again, pull out the contract, point to the provisions in the contract, and say, it's great that you said your guy had $500 worth of wages, but we want to see the time cards. So if you have Ralph on three jobs at the same time charging all three, we object to that. So we're pretty exhaustive in the review process long before it comes before you. But we do, the main reason to authorize a member of staff to approve change orders is to keep that job moving. We don't want to stop a job and say, okay, we got a hole in the ground. Our next meeting is 4 weeks from today, and we'll then tell you what to do with the hole in the ground. I mean, we don't really have a choice at that point. We need to keep the job moving. And then, unfortunately, we would be, if we did wait for to do anything until we brought it before the board, we'd be subject to delay claims, and not much we can do about that. Life moves on no matter what the law says. And the law is, in this case, it's unusual that a board has to approve a change order. So what you've seen is this development of this in-between thing where we can approve it at staff level, keep the job moving, and then bring it to you for ratification. But I really can't stress enough how thorough the process is. We're like a bunch of dogs worrying over a bone before it ever gets to paper even. So it's a pretty complete process. So in that box on the right-hand side, you see two of the methods. There are three methods at which we will allow a change order to be costed out or brought to us in its final form for approval. So, and one is the unitary cost shown in the very top box on the right-hand side, out of view there now. But and then the number one shown there is it's on a time and material base with a not to exceed cost, and we have within our contract a formulary that requires time cards, requires invoices, requires if they use their own equipment and want to charge rental for it, that they give us a corresponding rate sheet of the lowest available rental in the area, and that's what we pay them. So it's a pretty exhaustive piece of our contract that determines how they're able to add a cost to our change order. So the others, on the schedule of values is a unit cost. Actually, that repeats the one above. The one missing is where you get to a small item and the guy says, look, I'll do it for $50. And you say, okay, we'll take a bulk price, $50, because it's really not worth the time to cost it out, and yet he's due some money for it. So those are the three methods, the two you see there and then the bulk cost. So.
And one thing I would tie to for the time and materials, too, is we have an inspector of record on site. And so it's often their job to be at the physically watching, time carding, you know, writing down exactly how many hours it took to dig that trench, to fix that board. So, I mean, we have some of even more oversight at the actual site while it's happening. So there's a lot, as Ron said, just overall insights. And, you know, from this first summer of projects, I'm learning a lot in terms of construction and process and procedures, both from Ron, both in the field, from Anthony, from the team. And so what we found is that, you know, we have a pretty tight contract. I mean, it's very specific what they have to do and the amount of work they have to put in and the types of records they have to give to us to get through this process. And we're finding some contractors, it's difficult for them. They're used to just going through, putting stuff together, it's kind of that homework assignment. Here it is, to go back, revise, redo type of thing. So that's what we were just talking today in terms of even on our sake as a district, sitting down initially right when the contractor comes on board and laying that process out even better to them. Even though they've signed a contract that says all the things they have to do, I mean, literally walking them through that process, you know, and just because, again, once you have the contractor on board, it is a team thing. I mean, we want to be responsive. We want to keep the project going. We want to kind of have these adjudicated as quickly as possible so that we can bring them to the board. I mean, we have some projects that are completed, and we're still the change order process hasn't been completed because they're not getting their paperwork in on time. So those are things that, again, as Ron said, we're going to work on that process both with the contractors, with our own project managers, and lay that out, you know, in a better manner, which I think will hopefully expedite those so that we can bring them to the board quicker and kind of let you know what's happening. And then lastly, for me, the thing that I think is important for the board to understand is specifically the added scope. So that, you know, that's one aspect that, you know, I think it's important for the board to know the overall budget and to understand kind of where each project ties into that budget for the bond, because we need to be careful of the district adding scope to a project and what that's like. And so that's been another tool, and that's why you see us right now pushing so hard to kind of get the plans for next summer already, because we want to make sure that we've added that MoStrip, that we, you know, hey, if we're going to add that 2 feet of sidewalk along the edge, that's in the plans to begin with, that we're not, after it's been bid, we walk out there and go, oh, man, we forgot, you know, the architect didn't put this section in, or, you know, the asphalt goes up to one spot and now there's still dirt and it doesn't look complete. And, you know, so on our side too, we need to get ahead of that game and make sure that we have those in the contract tied in. So again, we've learned a lot, I would say, over the course of the summer and tied in, but Ron has been critical in terms of that last box oversight, to work with both Steve and Rick in particular, who are the project managers who've been doing the projects and overseeing those, all the change order paperwork, kicking it back to them, having them go back to the contractor, actually physically going to the meetings recently, you know, and making sure that we're, you know, again, being fair, getting things done and keeping those projects progressing as they need to. So questions on the change order process and kind of what we reviewed. I know you guys spent a few hours on it during the study session. And so really what I'm asking the board to do is to give me authorization to continue that, you know, kind of that ability to keep projects going based on this flow chart. And if a big change order were to come up, something that's huge outside of that 10%, I would be, you know, bringing that to the board, you know, at one of our board meetings, basically. But little things that are going to keep the project going, it would just be, I think, best for us to keep those, you know, those projects going. In the end, it all has to come back to the board. The board has to approve. What's that?
Preaching to the choir.
Yes. All has to come back.
So is this something you need a motion on, or you want a thumbs up, or what are
we
looking for?
Yeah, I think it would be good for the board to approve that authorization.
All right. Well, I would make a motion that we approve the change order process as described this evening. I don't know how else. Yeah, giving you authorization to proceed as described.
Okay.
I'll second that.
So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Did you have a comment, Mr. Unger?
I just wanted to thank Mr. Holcomb for meeting with me, not this Friday, but last Friday, and going over the change order process. The more I hear about Measure D and just the projects of the scope, the more complicated I'm aware that they are, and I just consider us so fortunate to have the team that we have to be keeping an eye on our public funds.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Holcomb. Mr. Pinkerton, I think you're up for the next item. The next item is a resolution number 03-16-17, Measure D, appointments to the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee.
So when we set up our Citizens Bond Oversight Committee, we basically drew straws. So that way we didn't have all the officers of the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee that they would all come up for or leave at the same time. So we drew straws. So the two people that drew the 1 year first term was Roy Silver as well as Ken Sanfilippo. Both have said that they want to continue on the Bond Oversight Committee. So they actually, the terms are normally 2 year terms. So this would be their second term, but it would be a full 2 years. So what we're asking is that the board approve their second term as membership on the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee.
Thank you. I'm seeking the motion.
I'll move approval of resolution number 031415.
Second.
So I have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Millar. Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisenrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mr. Questenberry?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Okay, moving on to the action consent agenda, please let me know if you'd like anything pulled. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 11.02.
Did we already pass once? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Approve request to apply for a variable term waiver for speech language pathologist. 11.03, acceptance of donations. 11.04, approval of warrants and payroll. 11.05, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement.
And we have an additional item that you can see on the screen up there. If you would refresh your computers, it would pop up, but we probably don't want to do that, though. And that will be the approval of the out-of-state field study trip for San Luis Obispo High School that you added to the agenda tonight.
Okay, and I can't see, Mrs. Holmes, you gave it number 12.08?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm seeking approval then of 11.01, 2, 3, 5, and 12.08.
I move to approve those items.
I'll second that.
So I have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. And Mr. Millar, warrants and payroll.
I pulled that because I have to abstain.
Okay, then I'm seeking approval of item 11.04, approval of warrants and payroll.
I'll make that motion. I'll second it.
Motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? So I have 6 in favor, none opposed, and 1 abstention, Mr. Millar. Okay. Does anyone have any items they would like on the advance agenda? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to reports by board members.
I have one.
Okay. I'm going to go right to left. Oh, Mr. Questenberry, followed by Mr. Buckman, followed by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, followed by Mr. Unger.
I'll make this brief. I was lucky enough to attend Morro Bay's homecoming game last Friday night, and I had a chance to talk with John Andre, the athletic director there, who insisted at halftime that I go in and look at the new wrestling room, dance room, cycling room, spin room, that's right, and so forth. And it was impressive, so I wanted to congratulate the people that worked so hard to make sure those things were in place and ready for the school year. He turned on the lights on the tennis court for me because he didn't think I'd appreciate it. I've seen it before, but seeing it at night, it's quite spectacular. So I thought I'd make mention of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I think Chris and Jim were able to attend the Teacher of the Year, honoring William Walters. It was an impressive event. I haven't quite seen anything like that in public education. It was a takeoff on the Emmys, and I have to say, it was amazing. And William gave a really touching speech and represented us very well, and obviously why he was named Teacher of the Year. It was great. I just have one other quick one. The Tri-County Education Coalition is we'll have Jack O'Connell as its speaker October 10th, 10 a.m. at the Goleta School District meeting room. Tri-County Education represents classified teachers, management, and parents from Ventura, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo County. Jack, this is a pretty informal setting, so everybody should really have an opportunity to sort of go one-on-one with Jack and ask their questions. If there's anybody that needs carpooling, let me know. I think it's well worth going. And I'd also like to just do a small shout-out to the Buildings, Grounds, and Transportation. I'm watching those. Often those are the things that the public sees more than the rest of the district. So the vehicles are clean, neat. They look great driving around. The schools look great. And I really appreciate it. Just want to say thank you. Thanks.
Thank you. I second that. Dr. Eisenrath Rogers.
I was able to visit Sinsheimer along with Mr. Unger and Mr. Millar. And just a few fun things to point out that we were able to do. We visited a first grade class where they were making applesauce and in acknowledgement of Johnny Appleseed's birthday. And Greg Parsons in the second grade showed us his classroom, what he's working on. And one of the things I noticed was a chart that he has where he compares how long students are able to sit in a seat and read silently to themselves from year to year. And the good news is that their ability to sit quietly and read has grown exponentially from year to year. It's just an incredible way of viewing that. So that was very fun. Also, I got to visit Baywood Kindergarten Family Literacy Night. And there was a chart on the kinder wall with the children saying what they wanted to accomplish this year, what their goal was for this year. And as you can imagine, there were, you know, I want to learn how to read a book. I want to learn how to count to 100. But one of them said, I want to learn how we are alive. His name was Ben. I'm looking up on Ben in about 40 years. I want to see what he's up to with his Nobel Prize. And the last one, was his middle school, Too Tough. And all I can say to you is that it's a good thing we did not do a board team. I don't know what I was thinking, but when I got there and saw that 10-foot wall you had to scramble over, I think it was a good idea that we didn't participate in that one this year. But we can train for next year.
Thank you. Mrs. Sheffer.
Just wanted to quickly say that Walt Millar and I visited the Media Center. And it was very informative, and it was great to see the enthusiasm, and very instructive to see the way Media Center resources are being tied directly to teacher classrooms. So it was fun to see. And then, as Mr. Pinkerton mentioned, I did attend the Citizens Bond Oversight Committee meeting, and was very impressed with how very dedicated the committee members are to doing their job and carrying out their goals successfully. They referred to their manual, their information. They made sure that they were doing what was within their purview, that they weren't strained, but that they were paying very close attention to what their actual duties are and fulfilling them to the best of their ability. So I was quite impressed.
Mr. Unger.
I did a couple of things. A couple of things I was reminded of. The first is that, I don't know if you all know it, but I'm a student teacher supervisor for a special education student at Cal Poly who is at Morro Bay High School in Bishop Peak right now. And so I got to go over to both those schools and meet their teachers, and I'm always impressed with the teaching we're doing. But as part of Morro Bay, I got to go over and see the pool, and they are really coming along on the pool. It's looking really cool. It's great. I mean, it's not just a big hole in the ground anymore. They're starting to put forms up around the sides and things like that. It's starting to look really good, and I was really impressed. I went to the Monarch Grove Family Reading Night, I believe it was last Thursday, and the multipurpose room at Monarch was full. Kids and parents in their pajamas. The literacy coach spent about 15 minutes talking about how to choose books, ways that you can engage your kids in reading. Every child got milk and cookies. They sat and read, and then everybody walked out with a book at their reading level. It was really, really neat stuff. I, too, stopped by Los Osos Middle School and was glad that I didn't get muddy and sandy and really awful. I went to Del Mar today, had a really interesting time talking to teachers at Del Mar. I will say that everyone is aware of what's going on fiscally in the district, and there was a lot of concern among staff about what's going on and how we're going to handle it. I think everybody realizes it. I am not convinced people understand the magnitude of it, though. And then just another thing that I heard today, just I think we should be aware of, you know, yesterday was the first Monday in October, which meant that the Supreme Court was back in session. There are a lot of things people are talking about, but there are two special ed cases in front of the Supreme Court this year that we better like be thinking about and following. One relates to the which takes precedent. That's how my understanding of it, ADA, the Americans for Disability Act, or IDEA. And this was an argument over a service animal. And so this is going to be a serious issue, because if it's ADA, the ADA has IDEA has very specific requirements that ADA doesn't have, and including due process and things like that. So we'll need to pay attention to that. More interestingly, as a special educator, though, there's a case that will revisit what was called the Rowley decision, which set what is a free and appropriate public education. The standard right now is that a child must make some kind of educational progress. That's never been defined. The argument is that the standard that's been used is too low. And so the Supreme Court is going to be asked to weigh in on what that standard should look like. Both of these have the potential for extreme costs for school districts. And I will say that they're being monitored by the National School Boards Association, but I do think it's something we should be paying attention to and perhaps weighing in on as well if it comes to it. So I just wanted to let people know about that. And then I will not be able to attend the meeting on the 18th. I have an obligation I need to be at in Fresno that night. So I know that we have some important closed session items. Perhaps I can call in for closed session.
Okay, thank you. Is there any... Seeing no other board comment, and having come to the end of my business, I think that we will stand adjourned until our next meeting, which is October 14th, a Measure D study session, and the next regularly scheduled board meeting is October the 18th at Los Osos Middle School. Thank you.